Every great story has a climax. It has a point where all of the motifs in the story reach a crescendo, an excitement, an intensity that just creates a sense of excitement. And we've reached that today as we look at this aspect of the creation, as we're studying beginnings. It's interesting for us to look at where time and space came from, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It's interesting for us to wonder, how did the oceans and the dry land get there? God separated them and made them. It's interesting for us to even look up at the stars and wonder, where did those beautiful things come from? And he made the stars also. But the thing that is of peak interest to us is, where did we come from? Why are we here? See, mankind, of all of the creatures that God has placed in this world, is the one that ponders his own existence. We tease all the time at home about the blank stare that Hank, our dog, gives us. I don't think Hank wonders about why he's here. He just wonders, give me some food and I'll be happy. Pet me and I'll be happy. When it's really cold out, we've noticed something these last few weeks. When it's really cold out, Hank likes to go outside a lot for short periods. And so he'll sit by the door and he'll whine a little bit like he's got to go outside. I just let you out an hour ago. You don't have to go outside. Not for the normal purposes of going outside, but we let him outside. He runs around for a few minutes. He comes back in. He's taken up the habit now of, he figured out that if he goes onto the back porch and stands up, some of you know that there's a window that goes into our kitchen right on the back porch, and he can stand up and put his paws on the window and look inside, and that's how he lets us know he's ready to come in. And so he'll do that, and we let him back in, and he's all hyper. And I said, why is he going out? I know he doesn't have to go to the bathroom. And I think it's just because he likes that sensation of getting cold for a couple of minutes. It must be really sort of sensationally thrilling to him. I'm guessing there. But yeah, I mean, that's animals. They live by their sensations. But mankind ponders a key question. Who am I? And why am I here? What is my purpose? What's my point? Why do I exist? And our culture is in an identity crisis. We're asking the question heavily, what's your identity? Who are you? And we're coming up with no answers. It's not a bad question, by the way, because your answer to that question, who am I? It's one of the most foundational, important questions you can ask yourself. Who am I? Leads to the question, why am I here? We are all intrinsically aware of our own existence. You know, we like to think that Rene Descartes came up with the statement, I think, therefore I am. But I mean, that question is really just a summary of what we've all known since the beginning. I'm here. But he broke it down to that simple phrase, and unfortunately for him, he missed a major point. His point was to question everything that you've been told and break it down to the thing you couldn't argue with. And he came down to saying, well, how do I even know that I exist? If that's the last point of knowledge that I can question, how do I even know I exist? And his answer was, well, I think, therefore I must exist. I think, therefore I am. Some people have taken that to mean that therefore the foundation of all knowledge is human thinking, and unfortunately that's wrong. He should have taken this one step farther to say, I think, therefore I know I exist. That's a good conclusion. Where did I learn to think? From whence comes this ability for me to perceive my own existence and to think? My thoughts come in rational statements. They come in words. Where did that come from? And Rene Descartes, being a faithless person at heart, was trying to deconstruct the world back to something other than God. The Christian philosophy of where does knowledge come from starts at the same place we just read a few weeks ago in Genesis, in the beginning, God. Not only did he create all things, but he is the fountain of all wisdom and knowledge. I think, therefore I am. Why am I? Because God. Where did I learn to think? From the mind of God. So that answer to the question, who am I, must trace back to God as the source of all things. And the ancillary question, the secondary question to it, not just who am I, but what is my purpose, what's my identity, is also wrapped up in that answer. God made me. And for 2,000 years, Christianity has answered that question definitively, fully, in a way that is satisfying to the human soul. Our culture's identity crisis has not answered the question for anybody in any meaningful way. Because what do they come back to if they push God out of the question, say, we don't want to use God to answer that question, who am I and what's my purpose? Everybody's encouraged to search out their own identity, and all they are left with is their own thoughts and feelings on the matter. And no matter how much they try to intellectually support the point, every soul knows that's an insufficient answer. Intrinsically, they know, I cannot be the definer of my own destiny. There must be someone greater than me, because if it all depends on me, woe be unto my soul. I know I'm insufficient. We want to wonder why our record rates of depression and anxiety have come upon our society. Probably we can find it in the fact that we have abandoned the only source of stability and peace that there is. We need to be stayed upon Jehovah. He is the answer to the question, and he's a satisfying answer to the question. As we go out there and answer people's questions, I'm not saying that we push people away for asking the question. They're desperate for this answer. It's got to be part of what we're telling them. Because it is such a foundational thing, we want to be able to bring a biblical answer to people who are struggling with their identity. People are struggling so much that they're not even sure what gender they are. God has answers for these things. He has solid answers. He has foundational answers. And he has satisfying answers. Answers that fulfill that desire for every purpose, for every person, to find purpose, to find meaning, to find satisfaction in life. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, because God is the source of all knowledge. And he is the source of all wisdom. His very being defines what is wise and what's foolish. His very character defines what is right and what is wrong. And if we don't find it in him, we're not going to find it. So Genesis 1:26, which is where we come today in our study, is foundational and key in understanding human nature. Without this verse, we're left to think that man is just merely a higher form of animal. Just through random happenstance, which I found out yesterday is a real word. Just through random happenstance, we have attained a level of self-awareness. But if the evolutionary picture is true, we've attained this level of self-awareness, but it's still pointless. There's no reason we're here rather than not here. There's no meaning to it all. It just happened. But from the biblical standpoint, why are we here? Let's review first of all, before we get into that, and I forgot to put it up on the screen, so we're just going to have to go from memory. Day one. Day two,
skies blue.
Day three,
seas and trees.
Day four,
stars
galore. Day five, birds that fly, fish that dive. Day six, the crowning mix. And day seven, rest in heaven. We're looking at day six. And we want to look at a concept that theologians throughout the ages have labeled with this term, the Imago Dei. It's a Latin phrase. If you ever wonder why so much is written in Latin, it is because the Roman Empire was so influential in developing civilization for quite a long time. So they spread the Roman language everywhere, which was Latin. And many of the church fathers for about the first 500 years wrote in Latin. And so a lot of our early works of Christianity come to us in Latin. The scriptures, however, were not written in Latin. They were written in Hebrew, the Old Testament, and Greek, the New Testament. So Imago Dei is a Latin term that simply means the image of God. So if you ever go to your doctor and they say, you have this thing, and they throw out this long Latin term, what's really fun is translate it, and you'll find out they're saying the same thing in Latin that they could tell you in English. You know, they just put it in Latin so you feel like you don't understand what they're talking about. This is how experts create a sense of their own necessity, right? We'll throw out terms that nobody else understands when really what I've said is the same thing you could have said in English, but in a different term. The Imago Dei is the Latin phrase that means the image of God. And this answers that question, who am I? See, we find something unique in this statement in verse 26. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. We're going to break this up into several studies. Today, all I want to cover is this concept of the image of God, the Imago Dei. Mankind is unique. We've already seen God create all of the animals. On day 4 and 5, he created them in different ways. He created all the sea creatures first, and then he created all the birds on that same day, and then he created all of the land animals and the creeping things. We took a look at that last week. I'm encouraged this week to know that mankind was given dominion over spiders. That thrills my soul a little bit, but I have a law for spiders, by the way. If they're out in the garden doing the thing they were designed to do, I leave them alone. But if they enter the house, they have forfeited the right to exist. And that's basically the way it goes. It's the same thing. I was going to say mice, but that's not really true. I unleash cats on the mice outside because they devour my potatoes. The mice, not the cats. Cats leave my potatoes alone. But at any rate, there's something unique about this. With all of the other creation events, God said, let there be, and then God made. And we looked a little bit at that symmetry in some of those statements last week. God declared his intention to do it, and then he did it. Something different happens here that sets the creation of man apart from everything else in verse 26. Then God said, that's the same as previously, but he doesn't say, let there be. He says, let us make. This intention is stated in terms of a unity of purpose amongst the Godhead. He states it in the plural. Let us make. This is one of the first references into the Bible to the fact that God is plural in one sense. We know he's singular in a very primary sense. His fundamental nature is there's one God. There's not many gods. There's not three gods. The Trinitarian formula does not recognize three separate beings. The Father is not distinct from the Son in the sense of being and nature. But there are three persons. The Father is distinct from the Son in the sense of personality. And here we have this very first, though it's a veiled kind of reference, it doesn't explain it at all. But it simply says, let us make. And he declares his intention to make something. Now, the fact that the Trinity states this intention in a very different way lets us know that man is going to be something unique. This was not said of any of the other created things. Not of whales, not of elephants, not of birds, not of cattle, not of spiders. Cool. Can you imagine the horror if spiders were created in the image of God? Let us make man. We're going to make man in our image and after our likeness. Those two terms get applied to man and set him apart from the rest of creation. As we just read in Psalm chapter 8, Ed read for us, David, in staring at the heavens while he's keeping his sheep at night, has a lot of time to look up into the night sky. And imagine the clarity of that night sky with none of the floodlights and city lights and things that we see around us. Abby likes to look at the stars. We have to hide behind one of the sheds back here to stop the church floodlights from drowning out what we're trying to see there. But David looks up at all of those things and he says, "When I consider the heavens, the sun, the moon, the stars that you've ordained, what is man that you're mindful of him? The stars are gorgeous. They're glorious in their beauty. They're brilliant. We sing another little song about them, like diamonds in the sky. They shimmer. They attract our attention. They're something that captivate our imagination. And yet David says, I see this distinction. Those are beautiful and glorious, but upon what has God set his affection and his attention? Is not the stars. He knows all their names, but man is the object of his special attention. Why have you done this? Man's not as glorious as the stars, but God loves us. Man's a little lower. That Psalm chapter 8 tells us, you've made him a little lower than the angels in glory and power. Now, it's apparent when the times in the Bible where it describes angels appearing that mankind is not as powerful as they are. Mankind is not as glorious as they are. We're not as bright and brilliant as they are. And yet, even though they resemble us in form, well, some of them look like men. Some of them are strange beyond imagination. But even there, God has placed his favor upon man. We can learn this from the rest of the scripture, that God has not provided for the salvation of the fallen angels. They made their decision. The ones that followed Satan in that great rebellion will be condemned, and there is no hope of salvation or forgiveness for them. It wasn't even offered. And the rest of the holy angels look upon God's salvation of man in wonder. Why has God offered to forgive these lowly things? And God did that on purpose to astound them, so that they would marvel at his grace, because we're offered the hope of forgiveness, and the angels were not. So even in that sense, man has been given a special place, even above the angels, which are more glorious and powerful than we are. Man's been given dominion of the world and all that's in it. And we certainly haven't really proven ourselves to be really faithful in that area either, have we? Sometimes we do good, sometimes we do not so good. But he tells us, well, we'll get into dominion later. I don't want to cover the dominion mandate today. I just want to talk about this idea of image, but only today insofar as it shows the uniqueness of man in the creation of God. So when he says, we're going to make man in our image, after our likeness, what is an image? Well, the word image in Hebrew means a shadow, or it can mean a representation or a portrait or a statue. Very often it's used of the idols that mankind would create. See, man, when they make idols, they know that's not the God. It represents the God. And so when they bow before an idol and offer it sacrifices, they believe the God is there in a special way, but they know that the wood and the stone are not their God. And so in the same way, there is a distinction in being between man, who's created in God's image, and God himself. We are not God. That is a fundamental point we've got to understand. So when we say we're made in the image of God, there is something about man that represents God, that reflects him, that looks like him. We're not purely talking about physical form, although that's part of it, but we are a portrait of God. When people look at us, they see a representation of God himself. You want to marvel at that for just a moment? When the angels look at us, they say, that looks like God. There's going to be an interesting statement made several chapters from now, when it says, when Adam was so many years old, he gave birth to a son after his own image and according to his own likeness. We recognize this principle in descent. Sons look like their fathers. Daughters often look like their mothers or their father. I mean, the mix-up, according to genetics, happens. Children look like their parents. That's why brothers and sisters often share such a striking resemblance. My brother came to visit one time. It was kind of fun because we went over to Gary's factory to show Mark around and see what was going. And I just looked over at one point while my brother was talking about something, and Gary's shaking his head looking at us, eyes going, huh, huh, huh. I talked to him later. He says, it's obvious you're brothers. Yeah. I inherited my father's rugged good looks. My brother's at the shallow end of the Jeep. No, I'm kidding. Mark, if you ever listen to this, I'm just teasing. We both bear the image of our father. We look a lot like our dad. In the same way, mankind bears the image of God. Adam, who at one point is referenced as the Son of God because he was directly created by him, bears a striking resemblance to God. He uses the word likeness as well, which is a comparative term. Actually, he uses this in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 18, when he says, to what will you compare me? And here in Genesis 1:26, that means man is the comparison to God. You want to compare something to God, say, what is God like? So look at man. That's what God is like. Now, throughout the ages, we have had a really difficult time actually defining what this is. What aspect of man reflects the image of God? We're going to take a look at a couple of quotes that I think are helpful in this regard. So here's one for you. This is the story of Martin Isles. He is, I don't know what you call, what is his position over there at Answers in Genesis now?
He's the second CEO.
Second CEO?
Yeah.
He's like Ken Ham and Martin Isles.
Yeah.
Everybody else. Martin Isles is kind of the heir apparent to the Answers in Genesis empire, but he's got a lot of great things to say, and he describes one time he's talking to his nieces and nephews, trying to explain this idea of the image of God. Well, there was a portrait of him that somebody had made hanging above his mom's piano, and they're sitting in the living room, and he references that, and he says to them, when we read that in the beginning God created mankind in his image and likeness, we learned that mankind clearly reflected and embodied something that was God's. Like those children looking at my painting, the angels could look at a man and a woman and see an uncanny resemblance to the Creator. I think that's a helpful description. We don't necessarily have to define every aspect of human nature that reflects the image of glory of God, except to say there is something about man that looks like God. We reflect his nature. The image of God is intrinsic to human nature. And it is not necessarily found in any of the individual components, but it is the sum of the whole. So do we reflect the image of God in our physical shape? Somewhat, but we know God doesn't have physical shape. But isn't it interesting that mankind alone, of all the created beings, is able to use these things in a way that no other animal can? Now, if it were purely in our physical makeup, then we would have to conclude that God himself has some sort of physical form, which we know is not true. And yet, to look at man and his ability to delicately interact with the world around him through his fingertips and through the rest of his body, we know this body does reflect the character and nature of God in a way that the animals don't. John MacArthur says it this way, the image permeates man's being. The structure probably consists of the complex qualities and attributes of man that make him human. Again, it's the sum of the whole. It's not the individual parts. We've talked before about intelligence. Is it the intelligence of man that makes him reflect the image of God? Maybe partly, but what about people who through some injury or physical malformity don't have the reasoning capabilities of the rest of us? Are they no longer in the image of God? Certainly they are in the image of God. That limitation doesn't stop them from bearing his image. What about little babies and children? Just because their reasoning capabilities are not on par with some of the rest of us, does that mean they don't bear the image of and likeness of God? Yes, they do. The moment they're born, you look into their eyes, you realize there's something intrinsically different about this little baby that I'm holding in my hands. When I look in his eyes, I see the image of God. Because when I look in my dog Hank's eyes, you don't see it. It isn't there. Even though we know some of the animals bear pretty striking intelligence, they're able to do what they do pretty well because God designed them and taught them how to do it. How do bees know how to build that complex comb? How do they know how to make honey? How do they know that when they need a new queen, if they take a worker bee and feed it royal jelly rather than its normal rations of food, it'll come out a queen? But they know, because God made them to do it. And yet, bees are not made in the image of God. We are unique. We bear his image. We represent him. We reflect him. The whole point of humanity is that we bear that image of God. And as we said, if it rested solely in one aspect or another, then we could argue that some people are exempt from bearing that image. And it doesn't matter which aspect of human nature you try to eliminate. Say, well, if it's physical form, well, what about people who, through one reason or another, have lost a limb or don't have the use of their entire physical form? Do they no longer bear the image of God because they're missing an arm or a leg? Of course not. They're still human. They still bear his image. That image is passed down, by the way, from generation to generation. In Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, and we're going to read about this one in just a bit more, but it talks about the institution of the death penalty after the flood and gives a very poignant reason. It says, "By whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, because in the image of God he was created." So that creation of the image of God didn't stop with Adam. It was passed down through each successive generation, all the way to you. You who are also created in the image of God. Despite the fact that we understand quite a bit about the physical processes that create each new generation, how the part of mom and dad come together to form a new person, how that grows inside of its mother's womb and develops, we maintain that from the moment a new person is created, that moment of conception, they are in the image of God. Just because they're not fully physically developed is irrelevant. They bear his image. They bear his likeness. And being created in the image of God leads to several consequences. I say our responsibilities. Leads to several conclusions. And number one is that every person, because we are made in his image, we are responsible to him. I'm going to turn to Acts chapter 17. I want to read this portion that Paul preaches to the philosophers in ancient Athens. If you ever have a chance to study what Paul says in Acts chapter 17, you'll find some remarkable references there. Paul tailored his message to his audience really well. When he's speaking to the Jews, he speaks heavily from the Old Testament scriptures because they have that foundational understanding of them. When he speaks to the philosophers at Athens, he speaks in a very philosophical way. Acts chapter 17, I'm going to start in verse 24. Understand, he's speaking to a totally pagan culture. Athens was filled with idol worship. They believed in multitudes of gods, not just one God. And so Paul lays down here, without any apology, without any hem-hawing, the God who made the world and everything in it. Now, if you paused right there, for most of us, we'd say, yeah, that makes sense. But think pagan idolater. They had several different creation myths about how the world came to be. But Paul just lays down what we've been studying in the Old Testament. God made the world and everything in it. It was not a result of a war amongst multiple gods. The world wasn't made out of the body of Tiamat after she was killed. That's kind of the Babylonian version. But it wasn't made when Zeus and his cohorts came together. God made the world and everything in it. That's a very biblical worldview. And he lays that down for them as the starting point. He made everything in it. What's the result? What's the consequence of him making the world and everything in it? Being Lord of heaven and earth. That term, Lord, is one that the Greeks understood very well. They had slaves, lots of them. And the word Lord means master. He's the slave owner. He's the one that directs everything. He's the one that gives the orders. He is Lord of heaven and earth, meaning God is the sovereign one. He's the master of it all. He does not live in temples made by man. There's a direct attack upon all of their idolatrous worship. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. There again is attack upon the idolatrous concept. Why do you offer sacrifices to your God? Because he literally eats them. He needs them to maintain his power. So all those mighty works that God does, or that their gods do, that's because they're eating the life force of the sacrifice you give them. So if people stop worshiping the gods, what will happen? The gods will get weak and sickly and maybe die. And Paul comes along with a biblical worldview, says, wow, that's awful. No, God doesn't need us. He doesn't need our service. We're not contributing to him anything. Why not? Because he made everything. He's Lord of heaven and earth. He's not served by human hands as though he needed anything, but he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. To the contrary, he doesn't need us. We need him. And he establishes this concept that understanding God as the creator of everything necessarily means we come to a position of dependency. We must recognize that he is the source of everything for us. We need him. Verse 26, he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. There's nice reference to Adam, right? From Adam and Eve come everybody. All the nations of the earth were divided according to what God determined. Verse 27, why did God do that? That they should seek God. God's program in the history of the nations is to give people this motivation, you should seek after me. You should acknowledge that I'm the creator. Are they doing it? No. But God's given them enough information in the created world that they are without excuse for not seeking after him. So verse 27, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. Brilliantly, Paul actually quotes an Athenian philosopher. He says, your own philosophers are saying this. In God we live and move and have our being. We're dependent upon him. So why do you guys think that you're contributing to your God's welfare by offering these sacrifices? As even some of your own poets have said, for indeed we are his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. What's he arguing there? We're his offspring, so follow this through from human experience. What do my offspring look like? They look like me. If we're God's offspring, if we're his children, then what does God look like? He looks like us. We reflect his image. And that should give us a clue as to what he's like. What do we do about all this idolatry? Verse 30, the times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Paul takes the Athenians from the argument, God is the creator of all things, God's Lord of all, God doesn't need us, we need him, we are accountable to him, and he is going to judge us. Therefore, turn away from your sins and repent and come to him. How do you know who the judge is? It's the one he raised from the dead. Well, who did he raise from the dead? You know, Paul doesn't actually get to that point because it's right there that the philosophers shut him down. You know, we don't really want to hear this. Well, of course they don't want to hear it. It's awfully convicting. But God, as the creator of us, necessarily moves us to say we're responsible to him. Every person created in the image of God will have to give an account for how well he bore that image. How much did I reflect his nature and character in my life? Did the decisions that I make reflect my understanding of being made in his image? And this gets down to answering that question, what is our purpose? What are we here for? We're here to bear his image. That very statement of our creation tells us our purpose. We are image bearers. So what are we supposed to be doing with ourselves? Reflecting him. Bearing his image everywhere we go. Good, look at Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, which says this, "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment and every secret thing, whether good or evil." This is the whole duty of man. Fear God and keep his commandments. What are we supposed to be doing? Bearing his image. And he tells us how to do that. He gives us commands that tell us, here's what God does, here's how he acts, here's how he thinks, here's what he wants us to be engaged in doing. Do this, don't do that. They're not arbitrary laws. God doesn't just make them up on a whim. They reflect his nature. So when we read things like, children, obey your parents, honor your father and mother, why is that command given? Because God is a God that has authority, and he wants us to respect authority. He wants us to follow those chains of authority. Ultimately, he wants us to submit to him as the ultimate authority. But that necessarily means that we ought to be people who are submissive to those chains of authority. When God says, you shall not steal, why does he say that? Because God is a giving God and he wants no one to steal things from him, to try to take from him. Satan is the ultimate stealer. What's he trying to take from God? His right of rulership, his very existence. If Satan could, he'd kill God. Which leads to another commandment. You shall not murder. Why not? Because God's created each of us in his own image. God is true to himself. He doesn't try to destroy himself, so we shouldn't attack his image by trying to kill each other. We're responsible to him, and so we must honor him with all of our lives. As the Westminster Catechism, thank you. All that was coming was confession, and that's the wrong one. Confession was the doctrinal statement. The catechism was meant to teach children what it said. First question in that Westminster Catechism is, what is the chief end of man? What's his chief purpose? And it is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. This is why we said at the beginning of this, Christianity has the answer to the question, who am I and what am I doing here? And it's an answer that not only is foundational, but it's also satisfying. We'll find our greatest satisfaction in life when we are fulfilling the very purpose for which we were created. Our entire life must honor God. So there's no aspect of life which is exempt or which exists solely for my own pleasure or my own benefit. Nothing in life is exempt from submission to God. Nothing. And everything about my existence, if I get it all from him, then I must return it all to him. Because that's why I was put here. I am reflecting his glory. I'm bearing his image. John Calvin in his Institutes of the Christian Religion writes this, and this is an extended quote, but listen in on this. It's brilliant. The knowledge of God must be such as effectively to plant in our hearts some seed of religion. Now understand, he's not using religion in the modern sense of the word. He's using it as a summary for all of what's Christian. This is so that first, we may be taught to fear and reverence God. And second, that we may learn that all good things must be sought in him. and that for these we owe him the duty of gratitude. For how can your mind conceive of God if you do not immediately see that you, who are his handiwork, are, by right of creation, subject to and dependent on his rule, and that your life should be devoted to his service, that everything you plan, say, and do should be referred to him? If that is so, it obviously follows that your life is terribly corrupt if it's not governed by obedience to his holy will. And then you, too, cannot clearly comprehend him unless you recognize that he is the fount and source of all that is good. That thought would surely make us want to be united with him and to trust in his goodness, except that our mind is kept by its own willfulness from properly pursuing its inquiry. Everything must be submitted to him. If he's the creator of all, and if we're created in his image, then everything must be submitted to him. So, in honoring God, I'll find the fulfillment of my purpose, and there I'll find the greatest satisfaction of my existence. In not honoring him, in living for myself, then, I'll only find disappointment. Why is our culture struggling with its identity crisis? Because it wants to find the answer for its identity in itself rather than in him. And so it will never find fulfillment and satisfaction in that. It'll only find disappointment and anxiety, discouragement, depression, confusion. Well, what's the second consequence? If we are created in the image of God, then give thanks to God. Romans 1, verses 20 to 23 describes the descent of mankind's culture from where it was created to where we find it. He says, his invisible attributes, that's God's, of course, his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived from the creation of the world. And I'll just note there, I think the ESV says, ever since the creation of the world. And I think the real sense of that phrase is not from the beginning, but from the creation itself. From the created order, we see these truths, that God is God. They are without excuse. Verse 21, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. They refused to acknowledge that God is God and that he's the giver of all good things. They refused to give him thanks for those things. And that led to a greater and greater descent into more vehement displays of wickedness. So what preserves both individuals, families, and cultures from descending into that wickedness? That first step is an acknowledgement that God is creator. This is why anytime you find any kind of society that at least acknowledges that, they're going to be better off than societies that reject it. Even if they're not fully Christian in their thinking, they acknowledge God as creator, and there's going to be a preserving influence there. Of course, we want to follow that through to the end result, which we'll get to here in a moment. But we should thank God. Anytime you enjoy anything, give him thanks. How many of you are planning on a nice meal when you leave out of here? And I know some of you are saying, if you ever stop, we will. But right? Yeah, we usually go home on Sunday afternoons and there's some kind of meal waiting for us, or we're going to go out and get something, and we say, oh God, thank you. Thank you for the time of worship. Thank you for the word you've given us. Thank you for the friends, the family that I enjoy. Thank you for the clothing. You know, we thank God for our life and our existence. We should thank him for the necessities that he provides, food, clothing, things like that. We should thank God for all of the enjoyments he gives us. You know, God gives us far more than we need. He gives us good things to enjoy. Do we thank him for that? God's also the source of all knowledge and wisdom and skill. Do you know how to do anything? Who gave that to you? You know how to repair cars? Who did it? You know how to take pictures? You know how to garden? You know how to do anything? God gives you the skill. He is the source of all wisdom and knowledge and understanding, and we ought to thank him and honor him with it. So that second consequence of being created in his image is give thanks to God. Thirdly, human life should be protected. Genesis 9, 5 through 6 says this, "For your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image." Being created in the image of God was the foundational building block for protecting life. Now this is a grant of authority from God to institute the death penalty for murder. And there's a lot we could say about that. You had to investigate it. You had to make sure that you were very certain this person committed that crime. If there was any question, you didn't put that person to death. I mean, God has a lot of standards written in the law that should be examples to us for our modern legal system. And in fact, the American legal system is in a great way built upon biblical example. So it's not just that you go around killing everybody that you suspect of killing someone, because if we kill somebody and they didn't do it, what have we become? Murderers. And we are then guilty. But it lays that foundational understanding that human life is something that is special, it's valuable, it's created in the image of God, it should be protected. We have applications of that in our modern society of if somebody murders someone, there should be punishment for that. We should protect human life from the moment it's conceived until the moment it dies. We should let God be the one that's determining when those things happen, because he's the one that creates and takes life. We have the right to take life only in very, very limited instances. Human life should be protected. So yes, that applies to things like abortion. Yes, it applies to certain elements of reproductive technologies. Now, there are a lot of forms of birth control that take the life of the baby. Look into them. Check out which ones do that. Most of them do. And those are things that we as biblical Christians should be standing against to say we want society to be something that protects human life. We want our laws to reflect that. It doesn't mean that we think anybody's going to get saved by good laws being passed. But it means we understand our accountability to God. And therefore, as much influence as we have in our free society, we want to bear that influence for the honor of God. Doesn't mean they'll listen to us, but it's going to influence how I vote. It's going to influence how I advocate. It's going to influence what sort of policies I want to support. Because I know that I stand accountable to God. I know that other human life is valuable. Therefore, we want to protect it. Well, it also has consequence for us loving other image bearers. 1 John 4:20 says, if anyone says, "I love God," and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Now, my love for you has got to flow out of my love for God. Your love for me has to flow out of your love for God. It's painfully evident you're not going to love me because of me. I'm not that lovable. And frankly, neither are you. And we can laugh about that, it's fine, yeah, we understand where we're going with that, right? But we love each other not because we're lovable, but because God made us. And that in itself means I owe you that, to love you and honor you and respect you as a bearer of his image. This all finds its fulfillment in one great place, and that is in Jesus Christ our Lord. He is the ultimate fulfillment of the image of God. Colossians chapter 1, verse 16 says, "By him all things were created." That's by Christ all things were created. "In heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him." We get into this brilliancy of God's plan that he created man in his own image so that Christ could become a man. Christ, who is the image of God, in a way that we're not. We are limited image bearers. Christ is a perfect image bearer. Christ reflects the nature and character of God perfectly. Even before we were in sin, we did it in a limited way. But God created man in his own image so that Christ could become a man and reflect to us the perfect character and image of God. He is the ultimate expression of the image of God in man. He's the one that we are to look to find that fulfillment, to find that purpose, to find our sin forgiven and our ability to reflect his image restored. Paul later says in Colossians chapter 3, verse 10, having put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. Sin ruined the image of God in us. It didn't eliminate it, didn't destroy it, but it ruined it. We do not reflect the image of God now because we are sinners by nature, and God is not. But in Christ, who died for us, who was raised again, we are restored and we are being renewed. Because as we become more like Christ by understanding his work better, by understanding his person better, we become better able to reflect the image of God. So, the beginning of it is understand you were created in God's image. And the end of it is, come to Christ. Put your faith in him. Turn away from your sin. And understand that he can save you and he can renew that image of God in you. And so as we close this morning, I want us to turn together. Number 66 is a song that just reflects the beauty of this trust in God. All that my God ordains is right. God's made us in his own image and he is caring for us. He's directing the steps of our lives. He knows the hairs of your head and he cares for you. So trust him. Let's stand together as we close this morning.